from the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're going to talk about growing efforts to ban Muslim women from wearing face veils and other forms of traditional Islamic dress in Europe. This issue got a lot of attention last year when a number of French municipalities tried to ban Muslim women from wearing the so-called burkini, a modest swimsuit that covers virtually the entire body. Those laws were overturned by a French court, but other restrictions on Muslim women's dress have spread and been upheld in European courts. France banned women from wearing veils that covered the face in public back in 2011. Since then, Belgium, Bulgaria, and Austria have passed similar measures. National bans on face veils are also under consideration in Germany, Switzerland, and Norway, to name a few. Now, in a few minutes, we'll hear from a panel of experts with some different perspectives on this issue. But first, we're going to go over just a bit of terminology about Muslim head covering, since these laws vary a bit about what is and isn't outlawed. Most people, of course, know about the burqa, which is a garment that covers the entire face and body, and the woman's eyes are obscured by transparent cloth. There's also the niqab, which covers the head and the face, except for a slit where the woman's eyes are visible. Finally, there is the hijab, which is a scarf that commonly covers the hair and neck, but not the face. So just to start things off, we're going to speak with Sahar Al-Fafi. She's a molecular geneticist who's also an activist with the anti-Islamophobia group, Muslim Engagement and Development, or MEND. She joins us from Cardiff in the United Kingdom. Sahar, welcome.
Hi, welcome.
Well, you live in Cardiff in Wales, and you wear the niqab, or the headdress that does cover all of the face but not the eyes. Tell us why you choose to wear it.
First of all, thank you very much for having me today. And thank you for this opportunity to explain the reasons behind my choice of wearing the face veil. And it's really important with the rise of Islamophobia across Europe. The main primary reason for me to wear the face veil, it's an act of worship. I believe it's part of my spiritual journey. I feel that I am connected to God by wearing it. I feel that I will be rewarded by God when I wear it. At the same time, I am not by any means undermining any woman who does not wear the face veil or doesn't wear the headscarf or anything like that. It is just my own spiritual journey and my own way to connect with God. And in this process, I feel empowered. I feel also liberated. And then you have the secondary reasons that, you know, it came eventually later on, that it has become part of my identity. This is who I am, a Muslim woman who wears the face veil, who is fully integrated within the society, who is a scientist, and this is how I would like to be identified. And with the rise of Islamophobia across Europe, and the banning that you spoke about is just the outcome of that, the face veil becomes also a symbol of resistance to all those who reject diversity or reject multiculturalism and respecting individual
Well, let me, if
liberties.
I might, if I could just pick up on that point, I understand that you have personally faced hostility or discrimination for wearing the niqab, the face covering. Tell us just a bit about some of those instances.
Correct. I mean, I had many, many incidents. The main one, it was really shocking because I was doing an interview with the BBC, which is a local broadcasting channel in the UK. And during the interview, actually someone passed by, looked fearlessly at the camera and said, "You're an F-word bomber." So this is what happens in the front of the camera. You can imagine what could happen behind it. I am also a geneticist. I work in a local hospital. So I had been abused by patients that I was interacted with or passing by. I have been abused verbally most of the time, but even sometimes physically when I go do shoppings, when I went shopping, someone tried to physically take off the face veil. So it's way spreaded, and it's unfortunate because it's almost Islamophobia has become the norm. You know, people have become or have the audacity to actually abuse a woman who just want to go on with her own life in the street.
Well, tell us if you would about what some common misconceptions you think are about women who choose to wear the niqab.
I mean, the main conceptions that Muslim women who chose to wear it is actually forced to wear it, and it's a symbol of oppression. Muslim woman who chose to wear it is actually isolated and is refusing to integrate and is uneducated and would like to stay behind closed doors and failing to be part of the society, which is absolutely untrue. But also we have to bear in mind that Muslim women who chose to wear the face veil are actually minority within a minority. So that's why you question why the banning of the niqab in this European country, if there aren't many Muslim women who wear it in the first place. You know, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to use the niqab as a polarizing tool to divide the communities when hardly anyone saw these women in the street? Or are you trying to gain some sort of political support, because now the geopolitical environment that Europe lives at, it glorifies Islamophobia or glorifies hate generally. And I feel that this kind of narrative is quite dangerous, because you might think it's impacting the Muslim women now, but it could actually impact anyone in the future, from LGBT to the Jewish community to the Sikh community. I truly believe that all of these communities have the right to express their faith in the way they want. If they're banning the veil today, they might ban the Jewish kippah, they might ban the Sikh turban in the future. So it's really collective.
Well, let me just pick up on one of those points that you raised, because my understanding is that the niqab, the face veil, it is most commonly worn on the Arabian Peninsula and parts of the Middle East where women's rights are significantly restricted. Can you see why some people might associate that then, or make that association or correlation between the veil and restrictions on women's rights, women's oppression? You would seem to be the exception in some ways, as being sort of a molecular geneticist, part of the educated elite. Do you see that perspective?
I am not an exception. If you were to go to the Middle East, there are so many veiled women who are educated and are part of the society. And also, just to put things into perspective, that women in the Middle East and these countries are not the only one who are oppressed. I mean, everyone in these countries are actually treated as second citizens. They are suffering from restriction on their civil liberties. They are suffering from dictatorship that are supported mainly by the Western countries. You know, we know Saudi Arabia, for example, is wholeheartedly supported by Trump. You know, no one is talking about the imprisonment of the political and civil rights activists there, thanks to the oil that we have. So it's really unfair to say that Muslim women are the only one who are oppressed in this country. The truth is that the whole nation in that region are actually suffering from dictatorship, oppression, and undermining of their own civil liberties. And it's for them to take that struggle and fight against it.
Well, Sahar Al-Faifi, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. On today's show, we're talking about the debate over Islamic dress in Europe, where a number of countries, most recently Austria, have banned women from wearing face veils in public places. To broaden our discussion now, we're going to bring in three other people who have been following this issue closely and have different perspectives on it. Joining us now from Brussels is Lina Vosselute. She's a researcher at the Center for European Policy Studies, where she's co-authored a recent report on protection of minorities in the EU. Also joining us in Washington, D.C. is Sarah Haider. Born in Pakistan and raised in Texas, she's a co-founder of the group Ex-Muslims of North America. And in Boston, Massachusetts is Celine Ibrahim. She's the Muslim chaplain of Tufts University and is a scholar in residence at the Andover Newton Theological School. Welcome to all of you. Let me start with you, Lina Vosselute, if you could. There have been some recent court cases in Europe, not specifically about bans on the burqa or niqab, actually, I didn't want to ask you about, but bans on the hijab, just simply the covering of the hair and neck. And these aren't national bans, but these are cases where employers have told Muslim women, you can't wear that at work. What have courts there viewed those sorts of restrictions?
Thank you for inviting me here. And it's really a problematic issue. As the first speaker has mentioned, it's European Union in its Treaty of European Union, Article 2, have recognized that democracy, rule of law, and fundamental rights, including rights of minorities, and which includes religious diversity, are founding principles of European Union. However, European Court, European Court of Justice, which is based in Luxembourg, has received two cases, one from Belgium, which was called Agbita, was the complainant, and from France, Bouganoui. And in these cases, court was asked whether employers' willingness to fire employees only because they wear a headscarf would be a violation of this founding principle which is in the Treaty of the European Union. So that's how it became EU's kind of issue. And
in both those cases, correct me if I'm wrong, the courts ruled that employers did have the right to tell Muslim women who work for them, you can't wear the hijab, you can't wear a headscarf at work. Why? What is their rationale for that?
Actually, in Belgium case, because company had neutrality rule, which means that they before implemented in their code the rule that no religious signs can be displaced in the workplace. The court kind of approved.
So, in other words, there was also a similar rule saying you couldn't wear a crucifix or a Star of David in the workplace as well.
This would mean that Sikhs would be banned from wearing turbans, that Jewish would be banned from wearing kippahs. However, any woman wearing a headscarf just for fashion would not be fired. And here is the paradox. However, in the second case, in the French case, court said that it was not justified, not strictly necessary for the aims pursued, and therefore, in this case, complainant won. However, court kind of made very open and broad doors for any company to introduce neutrality rules, and in this way, kind of preempt employing any headscarfed woman.
Well, let me turn this then to Sarah Hayter. You are critical of the veiling of women's faces. Tell us about your objections and your general perspective on this.
Well, my perspective is that the hijab is not—it's not a feminist symbol. It shouldn't be considered one. To say that women should be free to wear whatever they want, I agree with that, and that is something that I consider a modern principle, a liberal principle, a feminist principle. Having said that, not every choice that a woman makes is necessarily a feminist choice. And we have to be able to discuss this and talk about why something may or may not be empowering for women. When it comes to the veil, or to, let's say, just modesty in general, when it comes to religious modesty, specifically Islamic modesty, I mean, there is a reasoning behind it, and that reasoning touches on issues like a woman's worth is related to her modesty. As Sahar was saying earlier, she says that the veil brings her closer to God. And she's saying that this means that she's not judging anybody else who's not wearing it, but that's it necessarily cannot be true. If she's wearing it because it brings her closer to God, then that implies that women who don't wear it are not close to God. They are sinful in some way. So I think there is symbolism behind it, and that symbolism is something that is offensive to me, and it's something that I don't think is conducive to a modern understanding of what the role of women should be. Having said that, the fact that I find offense in something is not reason enough for me to ban it as a symbol in public life.
So obviously you live in America, and this discussion is very much a European discussion, I think. But in places like France, you can't wear the burqa in public places. You can't even wear the hijab to secondary school. Are you supportive of those sorts of legal restrictions?
No, I'm not. To the extent that when we're talking specifically about the face veil, any time that a face covering in general, like a ski mask or any kind of party mask, would be inappropriate or would present a security risk, then a religious face covering should be prohibited as well. But in any case where it's just an expression, I think it is an undue burden onto people to ban it. I mean, I think in a free society, you should be free to express your religious opinions, even opinions that people like me might find very offensive.
Celine Ibrahim, you are the Muslim chaplain at Tufts University. Tell us just a little bit about your experience. You wear the hijab. What reactions do you get from people on this? What's your response to critiques from people like Sarah?
Thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to be here. I think for many women, it is not simply a symbol of their commitment to Islam, but it's a spiritual practice. And so for me, if we can move the public discourse from judging it as a symbol to looking at it as a piece of clothing, number one, and number two, as a practice that for many women, it does bring them closer to God because it does help them in their public persona be able to present a less sexualized, perhaps, image. For many people who wear the face veil, it's a way to make sure that they're focused on their inner life, and it's a resistance in some ways to the ideal that the feminine beauty should be on display.
Well, Lina Vosilute, if I could turn this to you then. You know, there is some question about the symbolism behind the face veil, behind the hijab, and it seems like there at least is a chronological connection between terror attacks in Europe and the response, the initiative to try to pass some of these restrictions on dress there. I mean, do you see that there's a cause and effect between, say, an ISIS terror attack in France or in Spain and efforts to restrict Islamic dress among women within those countries?
I would say this, and not only this, as well as the European humanitarian refugee crisis in such countries like Lithuania, national parliament's safety and defense committee put forward also a proposal in 2015 to ban burqas in public. However, in Lithuania, if you know this country in Eastern Europe, it's not very diverse, and in total there were 2,700 Sunni Muslims living in the country, and not clear out of those how many they wore burqas. So actually in the end the proposal failed, and it was not the law was not passed, but I mean this effort itself is showing what kind of populist speculations can be made and what kind of symbolism it carries. Also putting together the refugee crisis, terrorism crisis, insecurity, and then trying to solve everything by kind of introducing Muslim burqa bans or burkini bans, which followed in south of France in the municipalities. Which is, I would very much agree with the first and the last speakers who are mentioning that it kind of goes against the gender equality calls. And there was some scientific evidence also. One of the scholars, Kilian, in 2003 already reported that in French schools, the burqa bans have led to lesser or lowering the numbers of schoolgirls enrolling because their parents were not sure whether or not they will be afterwards asked to remove the hijabs and so on. So they kind of then opted not to allow for girls to go for schools. Similar experiences in Turkey, there was one study implemented, which showed also that instead of employers risking, because previously it was that the women's wearing headscarves were prohibited from public places, that instead of risking employers to employ someone who is sending CV and this without a headscarf, or comes for the first interview without a headscarf and then appears to be wearing this, they kind of opted not to employ women in general.
Well, I think this touches on an interesting point, and I do want to turn this to Sarah Hayter now, because it does seem like part of the question, at least in Europe, is about the compatibility of Islam as sort of represented by the niqab and the hijab with Western values. And it seems like there's an argument that's been advanced by the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, as well as many politicians on the far right, that says these simply aren't compatible with our values, with European values. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I would say that there are a lot of ideological components behind behind veiling in general, and there are some aspects of Muslim practice that I would say are not very, they don't really cohere with liberal society and with the conception of who we are. Having said that, the way that you handle groups of people who might not fit in exactly how we would like, or might present some sort of problems, is to have a dialogue with them, is to talk with them and try and persuade them in the same way that European society, Western society came onto liberal values in the first place. I mean, they didn't grow here overnight. It wasn't just that Europe was always a liberal place or that America was always a liberal place. We came here because human rights campaigners, feminists, civil liberties activists argued for certain rights and certain principles, and they convinced the majority of people to adopt them. And there's no reason that Muslim Americans or Muslim Europeans can't also get there. But we have to be willing to acknowledge, first of all, that there is a difference right now. As it stands, there is a difference. There is a departure from what we would consider modern liberal values. And we have to start from there and then move forward in an empathetic manner, and acknowledging that they're rational people, and then there are people that are persuadable, just as if in the same way Europeans were, in the same way Americans are.
And Celine Ibrahim, there are a number of arguments that do that proponents of these types of restrictions in Europe specifically have used to sort of advance these bans. One is on security, and that bans on the face veil, on the burqa, are needed for security reasons. The other, I think, as we just touched on with Sarah, is sort of a cultural one, saying that even Chancellor Merkel, I believe, said that this is just simply incompatible. Veiling the face is incompatible with German values. I guess this is sort of a corollary to the argument that if you visited a conservative Muslim country, if you visited Egypt, if a woman visited Saudi Arabia, she would also maybe dress modestly or wear a headscarf in those contexts. What's your take on that?
I think the policies are often embedded in the logic of Islamophobia and in the logic of xenophobia. I think the policies at times are used to target women's bodies and minorities as the site of a discourse. I think Seher used the term as political tools. I think that that's quite apt. And furthermore, the discourse is often used against Islam and against Muslims in order to really affirm a European cultural hegemony, which is it's problematic. We at least have to understand, if there are security concerns, how we can work around those. There's plenty of ways that we could work together in terms of developing evidence-based policies. The problem is that we have to confront the logic and the rhetoric of Islamophobia and xenophobia in particular.
And so it sounds like you feel like these arguments are kind of a cover in some ways for xenophobia, for Islamophobia then.
In many ways, yes. I think that's very much part of the debate and the reason why this is not simply about security or not simply about integration into society. It flows from centuries of kind of cultural attempts to gain dominance over another race or another religion.
Well, let me turn this to Lina Vosseluthe then. In the Netherlands this year, the far right party there won the second most seats in parliament. The leader of that party, Geert Wilders, he campaigned on a platform to close all the mosques in that country. There's also been efforts to advance burqa bans in the Netherlands. Is this something that could be allowed to happen in an EU country? Is this sort of part and parcel of this argument about assimilation and bans on the face veil?
Well, as much as European Union has its own treaties, member states have their discretion and powers to do a lot of things inside what they want. However, we have to see it in the broader context also of Brexit happening in the UK, which was also very much run with a similar arguments, anti-migrant, which then again goes anti-Muslim, Islamophobic arguments. Then we saw also campaign in France with Marie Le Pen also kind of holding this anti-migrant, anti-Muslim arguments. And it seemed that in some countries, It worked out for the domestic purposes. I mean, what is scary for European politics or looking at the future composition of the European Parliament and what kind of decisions they will make. And here I would come back to our study where we see that increasing Islamophobia raises very serious questions about the rule of law and the safeguards.
Our time grows short, and I do want to give just the last word to Sarah Hayter with about 40 seconds left. You are a feminist and a secular humanist. You're also a critic of the veil, the niqab, of some aspects of Islam. Does it give you pause when you see far-right parties like this far-right party in Germany and the Netherlands and other places making this an issue, making these bans an issue? And where do you see this going over the next few years?
Well, absolutely is disturbing to see that the right wing and all over Europe and even in the United States is just owning this issue of women's rights. And they shouldn't own this issue. And the reason that they do is because Western feminists and Western liberals have dropped the ball here. Western feminists and Western liberals should have been the first to say that there are aspects of the hijab that are not compatible with liberal values, with modern values. They should be the ones to tell religious conservatives, people who are spreading patriarchal ways of thinking, that this isn't right and women shouldn't be treated that way. And because Western liberals and Western leftists did not take this issue on because they decided, oh, this is not the right time to talk about this, now the right wing has taken over this issue. And unfortunately, they are gaining credibility all across Europe, all across America, because they are the only people that are willing to talk about what is actually going on here. Meanwhile, everybody else says that it has to do with hegemony or with imperialism or whatever it is.
I'm sorry, Sarah, we're just out of time for this edition of Global Journalist. I'm sorry to have to cut you off. Global Journalist is a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Sahar Al-Fafi, Lina Vosilute, Sarah Hayter, and Celine Ibrahim for joining us. Our assistant producers this week are Aylin Beaton, Edom Kasae, and Raina Sims, with supervising producer Lauren Workman. Our visual editor is Elisa Blyle. Kyle Felling is our audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.